Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. Today, we talk about water use in the West. So, as always, George, first off, thank you for all your great work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
You bet, Derek. Thank you for having me.
So, let's talk about water use in the West. How is the water used in the West?
All right. Well, not surprisingly, or maybe surprisingly to most people, especially living in California where there are large urban centers, the vast majority of water consumed in the West goes for agriculture. And that's even true in California, where about 80 to 85% of all water use is for agriculture. And most people know that California is a state that grows a lot of the nation's food, but what they may not realize is that of that water use by agriculture in California, the vast majority of it goes to growing hay and irrigated pasture for livestock food, not for food directly consumed by humans. So despite things like all the urban centers like Los Angeles and the swimming pools and the golf courses and so forth, urban use of water is really a small portion of the water consumed in California. And it's even more stark in the rest of the western states where you have much lower populations. So a state like Montana, where there's virtually, you know, there's only about 1 million people living, 97% of the water consumed in the state is for agriculture. And Montana, being colder and just not on the major areas of growing food, like lettuce or strawberries or anything like that, is almost all the water in Montana is used for livestock forage production, hay and pasture and so forth. And so you find the same statistics all across the West. I constantly read about how the Front Range in Colorado is, you know, taking water from the West Slope for the cities there. But what most people in Colorado don't realize is actually most of the water goes, again, for agriculture, not for the cities. So we have this huge use by agriculture for irrigation, primarily of hay and alfalfa for livestock. And what may be surprising to most people, we hear about water rights. Irrigators constantly refer to water rights. And where that comes from is back actually in mining days is where it got started. For panning for gold and for sluicing, etc., the first person on a stream had the priority rights to use water, and successive people who came in were further down on the line. And that's how the whole concept of water rights came about, which was transferred to agriculture in the same way. So if you started to divert water from a stream back in 1880, you were first in the line compared to somebody, say, diverted additional water in 1900. However, throughout the whole West, in all the Western states, the water is legally owned by the citizens of the state. So, for example, in California, water in California is owned by California citizens. And any attempt to divert that water is only allowed as long as the citizens of states find that acceptable. For the most part, that has not been tested in court. But one example from California was when Los Angeles was diverting water, still does, on the east slope of the Sierra Nevada, and taking it down by pipeline and canal to Los Angeles. And shrinking Mono Lake, and it was called the Mono Lake case. And environmentalists in that situation argued that as a public trust, the state of California was violating its obligation to protect the citizens' water. and things like the level of the lake in Mono Lake. And they won that case based on the public trust doctrine. And that that public trust doctrine so far has not been applied to other water cases in the West, but it is something that is out there that may be used in the future, particularly as the attitudes of people have changed about water in the West. One of the problems with all the irrigation removals, and again, I'll use California as a good example, the removal of water from streams, of course, has a big effect on a lot of wildlife, including fish, and over four-fifths of the native fish in the West are listed as endangered or candidates for listing under the Endangered Species Act, and a lot of the reason for that listing has to do with water diversions as well as dams that, of course, fragment aquatic ecosystems, and they kind of prevent things like salmon from moving to spawning grounds, etc. And most of the dams in the West are used for water storage, with irrigation being the main purpose of them. So you have places like Lake Mead in Nevada, Lake Powell in Utah. Those were designed for water storage, and primarily. And they do have hydroelectric functions, but the hydroelectric functions are used to subsidize the irrigation program. So most of the irrigation water that is handed out through various dam programs around the West is sold at either nothing, no cost to irrigators, or very little cost to irrigators, who essentially get it for free. And another irony of the whole system is that a lot of the irrigators also get electricity from these same hydroelectric plants at a reduced rate. So you could be a person living on welfare in Sacramento and wind up paying more for your water use on a per unit basis than, say, a farmer in the San Joaquin Valley pays for the same unit of water. And so that, of course, encourages waste of water because it's so cheap in general. And that's one of the problems we have. It not only is agriculture using a lot of the water, but it wastes a lot of the water. And that waste happens in several ways. One, of course, you have irrigation going on usually all day long in hot, dry climates like the San Joaquin Valley or parts of Arizona, et cetera, Nevada. And that there's a tremendous amount of evaporation. So, even if you thought it was a good idea to grow hay with that water, spreading it out on the crops with sprinklers in the middle of the day when it's 115 degrees out and the humidity is 5%, you're losing a lot of the effective irrigation value. And then you have the dams. Dams like Lake Mead and Lake Powell that are in the middle of the desert, you lose a tremendous amount of water to evaporation from their surfaces. So we're wasting water that way too. So the end result of all this is that we have out-of-date and outmoded laws and policies concerning water. And a lot of people are saying, you know, I just soon see the salmon get some of this water, or I just soon see water kept in the lake like Mono Lake to keep it from evaporating away. We have a lake in Oregon right now, Lake Albert, Abert, Lake Abert is how it's said, which has just about disappeared due to irrigation withdrawal. It's just like Mono Lake was disappearing. And it was an important, like Mono Lake, an important flyway, stopover for birds traveling north and south, refueling on the shrimp that were found in that lake, just like in Mono Lake. So, you know, this is having a big impact on wildlife across the continent due to this irrigation withdrawals that are shrinking the lake. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's I have so many directions I want to go with this. I guess one direction I just want to mention is that I interviewed Felice Pace a couple weeks ago about the agreement to remove the dams on the Klamath. And one of the questions I asked is, will this agreement materially help the salmon? And he said, actually, no, not particularly. And the reason is because, yeah, the dams are a problem, and especially because they have no fish ladders, so they destroy, you know, there is no habitat above for the fish. But the real problem is the water removal for exactly what you're saying, the water removal for agriculture, and removing these particular dams on the Klamath does not do anything to solve that particular problem, which is one reason the Hoopa are against the agreement as it stands, because they need to have the dams removed and, in addition, these dams removed, and in addition, stop the removal of water from the Klamath and the Trinity.
Well, that's exactly the problem. A lot of the, just to take off on that point, a lot of these rivers and streams are also over-allotted. In other words, legally, users, irrigators, can take more water out of these streams than even exists in most years.
Well, a great example of that is that the Colorado River is currently, I believe, between 110 and 120% allocated, and they're building additional pumping stations to remove more water. And just to be clear on what that means, is that that means that the irrigators and everybody else who can take water they have the right to take more than 100% of the water that's in the river, which, of course, is what
exactly
happens, which is why the Colorado River no longer reaches the ocean.
Exactly. I'll give an example that was from my personal experience. I lived in Livingston, Montana, on the Yellowstone River, which is known in the state of Montana as a, quote, blue ribbon trout stream. Yet, every tributary to the Yellowstone in drought years runs completely dry because of water withdrawals for irrigation. The only reason the Yellowstone River is a famous trout stream is that it comes out of Yellowstone Park with lots of water. In other words, there's no irrigation withdrawals occurring in the park, but the same amount of water volume that leaves the park at Gardner, Montana, and basically is all that reaches Livingston, Montana, 60 miles downstream. And if it were not for Yellowstone and the protection that affords to the headwater streams, the Yellowstone would be probably, like a lot of other rivers, not a very famous for anything except for providing some water for hay. So withdrawals and over exploitation is really one of the big factors in affecting fisheries. It definitely is one of the reasons why a lot of fish species are endangered throughout the West. And if you throw in the water developments as well, you know, the effects of dams, those two things. And the dams affect things not only by blocking migration, but they change the water quality that's released. A lot of dams release water from the bottom of the dam, which is really, really cold, and that may be different than what historic conditions in the river. So, for example, Glen Canyon Dam, which is blocks Lake Powell on the Colorado River, releases cold water downstream, which has had a negative effect on a number of the native fish species there, which are used to warmer water and so haven't done as well, and in fact are listed as endangered or threatened under the Endangered Species Act because of the change in water quality. So, you know, it's a big problem throughout the West.
So I want to back up a minute, and you talked about the San Joaquin Valley. And I've spent a fair amount of time in the San Joaquin Valley, and it is mile after mile of almond ranches and apple orchards and orange groves and alfalfa fields. And can you give like a one-minute picture of what the San Joaquin Valley was like prior to conquest? Everything I've heard is it was a paradise.
It was still a desert, but it was a desert like a lot of desert areas. It had some fairly large lakes, native lakes, shallow, but still, you know, with water for waterfowl. And the San Joaquin River had salmon running up it prior to all the dams, etc. And so it was, you know, tremendous fish runs. And you had, you know, tule elk out in the valley there, and grizzly bears, and of course San Joaquin kit fox, and a lot of species that are on the ropes right now because so much of the valley has been converted to agriculture. And again, I want to come back to the point that, you know, you mentioned things like apples and oranges, which do make up a significant amount of the agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley. But without having the numbers right in front of me, I'd be willing to bet you'd find that pasture and hay is still by far the biggest use of water there. So even if one were to say, okay, we think it's valuable to grow oranges there, you know, because that's a higher value crop. If we got rid of the low value crops like alfalfa and hay, which are relatively speaking on a per acre of water used, low value crops, we could restore a lot of the valley. And you know, what's particularly galling in recent years, a lot of that hay is being exported to China and other Asian countries.
And Saudi Arabia as well.
Yeah, wherever it's going. The fact is we're dewatering our streams, and in a lot of cases, I haven't mentioned this yet, but groundwater as well, to grow this sort of low-value crop, and at the expense of the native species that depend on that water and that landscape. You know, one of the things that I think I want to make a point, especially since we're talking about Central Valley in California, you know, when you go up and down the Central Valley, I've traveled more the northern part of the Sacramento Valley than the southern part. But what you see is not big cities or anything. What you see is, you know, mile after mile after mile of cropland. And I think people don't appreciate how much agriculture has changed significantly the landscape. People focus on things like housing projects and so forth, which definitely, of course, do change the native vegetation. But if you're going to look at a percentage of the landscape that's been modified, and usually not from the, you know, modified from to monocultures of exotic plants, then agriculture is by far and away the biggest impact on the landscape. And so that behooves us. You know, no matter what, I know where you would come out, Derek, you'd say, well, we need to, you know, give it all back to the wildlife. But even if you were going to go partway there, we can say that we can at least be more efficient in how we approach this and say, you know, what do we really need to be, you know, growing here? Is growing hay to export to China really a good use of this land, especially when it has such serious impacts on, you know, native biodiversity and wildlife. So I think that the idea that we need to irrigate so much land is, it really needs to have a serious discussion.
Oh, I don't disagree with you at all, and I'm obviously you understand my position of we need to give it all back to the land, but right. But at the same time, I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy, and I fully believe in doing, I mean, I wish with every cell in my body that we were using the cleverness and intelligence that we always claim humans have to actually solve problems instead of create them. And
right.
I have no problem with using technical solutions, you know, to try to mitigate some of the harm. So, of course, I would agree that things should be better. There's a couple directions I want to go with it. Like, two directions I want to go. One of them I want to talk about in a minute, the notion that attitudes are changing, and I want to bring up something about that Donald Trump said about that in a moment. But before, okay. I want to hit again the notion, just the grotesque, complete, can you walk me through their rationale, which I think is probably just money, but their rationale for growing and you know, I know you don't have the numbers in front of you, but sort of, you know, make up whatever economic numbers you want with the full recognition we're making them up. how can you do something so stupid and insane as to grow hay to send to China or Saudi Arabia? That seems to me just an example of everything that is wrong with the entire global economy.
Well, you know, this gets back to all the subsidies that we bestow, particularly on agriculture, which distorts the economic rationale for a lot of this stuff. Again, if you're not paying anything or paying very little for the water, that makes it easy to justify growing, you know, hay in a dry desert. When you can grow, I mean, not that I'm advocating this, but if you wanted to grow hay, you could grow it in some place like Missouri, or Vermont or Kentucky or wherever, without irrigation. Because the water is nearly free and the electricity to run sprinklers or pumps is also nearly free, that makes it easier to make a profit on this stuff. So part of it, of course, you know, and I'm not naive. Reforming agricultural subsidies is not going to be anything easy to do, but that right there would change, I think, a lot of the sort of the economic calculus of people that are growing the stuff and exporting it. Right there is a quick way to do it. Not that it's an easy way.
So when the next president of the United States puts you on the cabinet and makes you minister of all things water in the West, one of the first steps you would take would be to reduce the subsidies for reduce or eliminate the subsidies. You would make them pay market value for water coming out of rivers, at the very least. Is this what you're saying?
I would do that at the very least, and I would add in the ecological costs. For example, and this gets lost all the time in the discussion. The taxpayers in this country, all of us, are paying to, say, recover salmon. And there are many other species I could name, but we're paying, you know, millions of dollars to recover salmon, and there are a lot of factors that are causing salmon to go extinct. But one of the factors is dewatering of rivers and the changes that happen in the water that negatively impact salmon. And so I would try to include those ecological costs, of which are, of course, in most cases, we only have a vague notion of the value, but we know it has value, and it's more than zero. And so if you start throwing in the ecological costs on top of the just pure economic subsidies, you know, a lot of this agriculture would never occur in the first place. And so that would be one approach.
So now I want to come back to, you said earlier that attitudes are changing. And I think that there is some truth to that, but I want to tell you, I was over at my mom's, and there was a Donald Trump speech. He was speaking to farmers in California, and one of the things he said to them is something that farmers say all the time, and I have also seen this in newspaper editorials, which is, he said, there is no drought in California, which is something that got a lot of play around the country. But his next sentence did not get as much play, which was, because there's still water in these rivers reaching the ocean, and any water that reaches the ocean is wasted. So, mm-hmm. That seems obviously insane to me, but A, can you make very explicit, because discourse in this country is so poor, can you make very explicit why water that reaches the ocean is not wasted? And second, can you talk about the changing of attitudes with, at the same time, understanding that this other notion that water that reaches the ocean and a river is wasted still has enough currency that a politician running for president can say it and receive an ovation for it?
Okay, if I wanted to be real cynical, I would say to Donald Trump, well, you know, if we stop all the water from reaching the oceans are going to shrink, and that, then how are we going to get ships back for it? But, of course, I'm just being facetious by that. But this, ecologically speaking, that'd be one thing I could say. You know, the rivers reaching the ocean create the mixing of fresh and salt water, which is one of the most productive ecosystems on the planet. And that brackish water is where a lot of the fish and shellfish and so forth, are either nursery areas for or places where they live, and lots of birds, etc.
Okay, hold on a second. You know, I'm shaking my head because you and I are both, you know, fairly intelligent people, and we're both care about the world, and I can't believe that I actually just had to ask you why it's okay for water to reach the ocean. I just have to point out explicitly how stunningly absurd that is.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. But it's one of those statements, like sort of like Ronald Reagan, you know, you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all, kind of thing, which also I find an incredibly foolish statement. But nevertheless, I always don't like using human rationale for, but when the one thing I do this a lot is because I'm dealing with people that's the only thing that they understand. And even conceding that it's the only thing they can understand, I can usually make a pretty good argument why it's in their self-interest to take a different position on a lot of these issues. And in the case of water reaching the ocean, like I said, it produces a lot of the food and other seafood that we consume, but it also helps to keep the pollution levels, you know, more diluted, you might say, and has, of course, the value of providing a way for, in the case of like the San Joaquin Sacramento River, is a good example. There is commerce that goes up and down that ships and so forth to Sacramento. So, you know, just from a self-interest point of view, that was a stupid statement. But, you know, the other thing I want to point out, because just my mind is going here right now, and it's another important point that has to do with the irrigation, is that the irrigation use of water also causes a lot of pollution, too, that people may not think about. For example, you spread this water out on a field where you've gotten a lot of cows concentrated. You get nitrogen seeping back into the groundwater and or back into rivers and streams afterwards, and fertilizers and also pesticides, etc. And so that's another problem with a lot of irrigators will say, well, we put the water back in the stream eventually, or it gets in the groundwater and eventually refurbishes the groundwater, but it's changed its quality considerably in the process. And that's another cost that's seldom considered.
So what, how?
What do we do?
Well, I'm not quite there yet. Let's wait on that one for about another 7 or 8 minutes.
All right.
I'm trying to think about. Let's go back to the water rights question.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, people who came and started pulling. You went through fairly quickly. Can you go through a little bit slower on the first in time, first in right idea, and talk about some of the damage that notion causes?
Okay. Again, the idea behind it is the first person or persons who diverted water from any stream for what was called a beneficial use, and that's another problem. In a lot of states, keeping water in a stream for, say, fish or just, you know, natural beauty or any purpose other than what's considered an economic use is often not considered part of the beneficial use. In any event, taking water out for what is defined as a beneficial use, such as irrigation, is determined by the sequence or the year that diversion occurred. So the earlier you started diverting, and the amount that you diverted is legally protected. Relative to other later people who might divert water. It doesn't mean that you have, I'm just going to make up some number. Let's say you're allowed to divert 100 acre feet of water per day from some stream because that's what you did in 1880. That doesn't mean that you're guaranteed 100 acre feet of water because, again, the water is owned by the citizens of the state. And if the citizens of the state decide or the state government can be challenged to protect the citizens' interests in other areas of water, then what would happen is, I'm just going to put forth a scenario that could happen. If you had a challenge on using the public trust doctrine on water usage in a state, you might come up with a solution that says half of the minimum flows, 50% of the water that should be there during minimum flows, will remain in the stream. And then what would likely happen is that irrigator A, who had the very first water rights by the beneficial use clauses, would get their water. Those who were further down would get less water until you got to the point where there was no water left to distribute. So later claimants would have no water. Or if you wanted to be more fair in how you delegated that water, you might just give every user a percentage reduction in water available. So if you had your 100 acre feet in the first person who diverted water, you might cut that to 75 acre feet and everybody on down by 25% so that there was still enough water left for maybe the last people in line to have a little bit of water for irrigation. But nevertheless, you'd maintain flows in the river or stream that would hopefully be sufficient for fish and other wildlife that are living there.
Okay, so in 1880, I'm making this up, in 1880, yeah, my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, however many greats back, grandfather decided to pull 100 acre feet out of the stream, and he was the first person who had ever used the water. Of course, no fish had ever used the water. No grizzly bears ever used the water. No Indians who lived there had ever used the water. You know, this is the beneficial use problem. You know, is that,
right,
that my use is the only one that counts. But we'll forget all that.
Right.
And
right,
so I pull 100 acre, or he pulled 100 acre feet out, and that becomes a right which can then be sold or passed on through inheritance. And so my family did not sell it. So it came down to me. And now you, being the sort of eco-commie that you are, I'm making a joke, you're trying to get a what's called a public trust doctrine put in place where that water will be, some of that water, that my 100 acre feet will be taken for fish. So if you do that, I am going to sue you to the Supreme Court because you're taking away my rights. Isn't this how it goes then? You're actually taking, this is a classic takings, is it not?
It's also a classic example of a giving. In other words, the citizens of the whatever state you want to talk about have graciously given you water for free all these years from our total allotment, which is owned by all of us. We are simply modifying the amount that we're willing to give up at this point. And, you know, I don't know how the Supreme Court would rule on this stuff, of course.
But basically, the positions we're saying would be the two positions that would probably be expressed in court, would they not?
Yeah, that's true. And I will say that the public trust doctrine idea is relatively new, but it is being developed in all sorts of areas. Right now, the area that is getting the most legal scrutiny is under the idea of climate change. You may have heard that there have been some recent court decisions in Washington and Oregon where kids have sued the state, respective state government, saying, you're not protecting my future because you're not doing enough to reduce fossil fuel emissions that are causing global climate change. And they are arguing that under the public trust doctrine. So this it has implications for all sorts of things. It could have to do with, I'll give you another area where I think it will be applied in the future if it's well developed, and that is hunting of animals by hunters and you know, probably with fishermen too. But the idea that you know, for example, grizzly bears should be killed in Montana and Wyoming and Idaho if they're delisted by trophy hunters, when most of the people in the country just want to see more grizzly bears, not see them as rugs on somebody's wall. And people would argue the public trust doctrine says that those fish and game departments are not protecting the public interest here. So this is a big legal thing that will probably be developed in the next 10 to 20 years. And I suspect, hopefully, successfully used to get more water in our rivers.
And I think another area where it's used is for clean air, because there are, I just read yesterday, I don't know if this is true, I only saw it in one source, but I just read yesterday that pollution kills more people around the world than gun violence. And I would believe it, but in any case, that becomes a question of somebody else polluting the air, which we all hold in common, and then that giving me, you know, some disease, that giving me cancer and killing me. And yep, so that's another area where I've seen it explored.
Yeah, well, you know, there's all sorts of ways that this could be used, but certainly what we have indirectly, and I would like to reiterate this all along, is agriculture in this country externalizes a lot of its cost. And in truth, perhaps things like particularly beef, which consumes the bulk of all that, I didn't mention this, the bulk of all that hay and alfalfa goes to feed beef and dairy cows. So people eating hamburgers and, you know, having milkshakes and Ben and Jerry's ice cream are getting subsidized in many cases by the use of irrigated agriculture. And if that were reduced or eliminated, the cost of those products would go up, and that would be one of the externalized costs that would then be internalized. And what you see over and over again is industries have gotten used to operating with a lot of their costs externalized and don't pay the real costs. And a lot of environmental laws that I see are an attempt to internalize those costs so that we as consumers can make more, you know, even if you don't care about the environmental and ethical issues, just, you know, making purely good economic decisions, if you have a lot of the cost externalized, that distorts your decision making.
So we have about 10 or 11 minutes left, and let's turn the corner to where you started to go about 10 minutes ago. And what do we do let's talk about the biggest scale first. What do we do about this problem? You've sort of hinted at the public trust doctrine. What do we do about this?
Well, the first thing is, again, I constantly see, this is a minor thing, but it's one of my things that I write, is how language affects people's perception. So irrigators are always talking about their irrigation right. And whenever I see a writer do that, or even at a public forum where somebody says irrigation rights, I quickly pipe up and try to say, no, these are irrigation privileges. They are not rights. They are privileges that we grant the use of this water to individuals, and it's only because the citizens of the state are willing to do this. So changing the language on things would be one way to change the perception on it.
Wait, can we talk about that for a second more?
Sure.
Because
yeah.
I keep coming back to, I mean, I completely agree with you. And so when I ask these, you know, please don't think I'm disagreeing with this position. But it seems to me that you're going after a really central sort of core problem of this entire culture's way of looking at the world, because as soon as you, I mean, I live, just like you do, I live in, you know, an anti-environmental area where there's the water brigades. I mean, the water brigades were here where when they tried to, not allow water to be diverted from the Klamath to protect the salmon and the suckers, there was a very strong bucket brigade here that went up with weapons to protect, to prevent the sheriff from cutting off the water to the irrigators. And so I live in an area where you say what you just said, those are fighting words, and so there's a very strong pushback to that with them, I would presume, with them saying, no, these are not privileges, these are rights which you are taking from me, and you're taking away this traditional right that goes back generations. Once again, I'm not disagreeing with you, I'm saying what they would say.
Oh, yeah, yeah, well, the slaveholders in the South said the same thing, too. So,
thank you.
But, you know, we move on in society and recognize that we have obligations to other people and other living things. And I no doubt there would be a lot of dispute and argument, and there would be ways that would be devised to soften the blow for some of these irrigators. I mean, just looking at the economics of it, a lot of the there was some report done in the 1990s that looked at 133 federal irrigation projects, and out of the 133, only 14 were actually paid for by the irrigators. So all the rest are subsidized by taxpayers. So one, if, you know, and I'm not one that likes to pay for things that we already own, but nevertheless, sort of like buying grazing allotments out in Western public lands, you know, one solution might be to say to all these irrigators, well, rather than continue to spend money on all these dam operations and irrigation canals and subsidized electricity, we will take that same amount of money, which is, you know, hundreds, maybe billions of dollars, and we will simply extinguish your irrigation use forever. And then the water saved can go back permanently into rivers. That's one of the things that actually is being talked about with regards to irrigators in the Klamath River that you mentioned earlier. So that's one way to make it more politically palatable to some of these folks.
And before we go on to the next thing, too, I want to mention, we haven't really talked about this explicitly, is when we talk about people taking out, you know, the example I used was, you know, the theoretical example of my great-great ancestor pulling it out. But these water rights are, for the most part, not, are they or are they not owned by mom and pops, or are they actually owned by Nestle, Anheuser-Busch, you know, huge alfalfa mega corporation X, huge beef corporation X? And also, Barbara Boxer was, you know, politically in bed with the irrigators. I mean, she was a staunch ally of these large irrigation corporations. So one, who actually owns these rights? I know the people own them, but in terms of owning these rights the way they, owning these privileges, I'm so sorry, thank you for that. Owning these privileges, it is primarily large corporations, is it not?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is simply the same way it is with agricultural subsidies in the same way. The more land that you have under irrigation, which tends to be any more owned by large corporations and or very wealthy individuals, then the more likely you are to be getting a subsidized water use as a result. And I know there have been studies on that. That's been one of the arguments used in the past. I think George Miller, Congressman Miller, tried to reform water use and federal dam projects, and one of the arguments was that, you know, again, like all these things, the bulk of the benefits are going to those who already have significant financial resources. And mom and pop are out there using them too, so don't discount that. But again, we are in many cases padding the paychecks for the stockholders and the CEOs of very large corporate interests that benefit from this subsidy. And just on that reason alone, there's a good reason to change the way water is used in the West. And I want to get back to this whole thing of, you know, I harp on livestock forage in particular, because to me, it just seems crazy raising cattle in the desert. Someplace like Nevada is a good example. I did a book on Nevada mountain ranges probably, I don't know, 20 years ago at this point. So this is a little bit dated. But at the time, I believe there was like less than 3,000 jobs, full-time jobs in agriculture in all the state of Nevada. And if you know anything about Nevada, the only thing they're growing there is hay and cows. And not to say that casinos are great, but one casino in Las Vegas employs 10 times as many people as all the people in agriculture in Nevada. Yet that agriculture uses like 85% of all the water in Nevada, the driest state in the nation. I mean, it's just crazy the disproportionate use of water for things that are not very important economically. And you know, the country would be better off if we ate less beef in general for a whole lot of reasons. But one of it is it's the prime consumer of water use in the West. And I think when people learn that, they're kind of shocked because, you know, each hamburger they eat has got, you know, a couple of thousand gallons of water in it effectively. And when we're having, streams dry up or you're in the worst drought ever and somebody is telling you in California to put a brick in your toilet, and I'm not saying that these things aren't good to do water conservation, but nevertheless, when the people in urban areas are asked to put a brick in their toilet and take a 30-second shower, meanwhile we've got, you know, water flowing out on irrigated pasture fields 24 hours a day with half of it or more evaporating in the sun, it really isn't a very rational way to approach water.
So you've mentioned solutions, and you started one, and then I interrupted you. So can you go with the other ways you would fix this?
There are other ways to fix it. Of course, is to educate people so that they I think the only way you win this thing is by showing people that their own self interest, because that's the way most people are going to look at it. And the self-interest can be, you know, interest in wildlife and so forth, but we show that the self-interest is being affected. So, you know, I'm always amazed. For example, I've tried to get, for example, Montana Trout Unlimited to let me talk about water use in Montana, and they won't let me talk about it because they don't want to offend any ranchers. And, you know, yet from the self-interest of trout fishermen, there's nothing that you could do in Montana that would better improve trout fisheries than reducing or eliminating a lot of the irrigation. There are thousands of miles of streams in Montana that are dewatered every summer or impacted in other ways because of the pollution from water, you know, being warmer that goes back in after sitting on a field, that impacts those trout fishermen. So, you know, convincing trout fishermen, and I'm just using that as an example, that they would be really wise to join this fight to reduce irrigation is, I think, part of the solution. And in that regard, there are very few organizations that I know of that directly work on water issues in the West. And the few that I know are, there's a group here in Oregon called Oregon Water Watch. There's groups like Western Watersheds Project and based out of Idaho that focus a lot on water, but in general, it's ignored by most environmental groups in the West, and yet it's so central. You know, here you have groups that are trying to, for example, recover salmon, or talking about. I'll give you another example. There's an Oregon spotted frog here in Oregon that's endangered because of partly from livestock grazing and agricultural use of water, and yet the groups that are championing those species often ignore how irrigation and irrigated agriculture is negatively impacting those species. So drawing the connections and connecting the dots is really important for people to understand, and something that, for the most part, is still missing in a lot of discussions.
So we have like 1 minute left, and can you... Okay. What if somebody understands what you're talking about and they live in the West, and you said there's not many groups working on these issues? You know, a lot of the people listening to these shows are active themselves in terms of trying to do something good. So if they live in Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, California, Oregon, Eastern Washington, what can people do in addition to supporting the groups you mentioned. What else can they do if they want to help stop the dewatering of local rivers / streams?
Well, again,
how can they get started?
Yeah, well, I think it's getting educated themselves. You know, a really good book that came out years ago, but Cadillac Desert and another one, Oasis by Mark Reisner, talks a lot about these issues. And I think that if anybody wanted to just kind of get up to speed, reading those books would just open their eyes to many things. And the general principles in those books would still pertain, even though maybe some of the statistics are, you know, a little different today. And then the other thing is trying, if you're a member of any organization, you know, more traditional groups that have a lot of focuses like Sierra Club or whatever, try to draw the lines together, the dots, so that they see that, you know, they're working to save some endangered species and it's affected by irrigation, to not ignore that water issue. And even things from, a human justice point of view, the fact that somebody living on welfare has to pay more for their electricity than an irrigator who's wasting water. I mean, you could broaden the interest among many different kinds of groups to focus on that. And then, of course, if you get enough focus on it, then you have potential for some sort of change.
Well, I would like to thank you for expressing the radical position that keeping water in rivers helps fish. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.